Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. You're listening to it on RN with me, David Rutledge. And this week, we're doing what so many people have been doing for so many thousands of years, consulting the ancient Greeks and Romans for advice on how to live well. David Bronstein is a lecturer in philosophy at the University of New South Wales. And over the summer break in January, he ran a course on philosophy as a way of life, which took a deep dive into the practical benefits of ancient Greek and Roman ethics. Jessica Putnam is a student who took the course, which involved, among other things, a week of living according to the principles of Stoicism, and we're going to be talking about the Stoics a little later in the program. So, David and Jessica, welcome to you both. David, I noticed that you have at the beginning of the course notes a quote from Nietzsche, which goes as follows. The only critique of a philosophy that is possible and that proves something, namely trying to see whether one can live in accordance with it, has never been taught at universities. All that has ever been taught is a critique of words by means of other words. Well, it's a very Nietzschean sentiment, but how do you read that quote and how does it speak to your own experience of teaching philosophy at university?
It definitely does teach to my own experience, although I think in a way different from what Nietzsche had in mind. Nietzsche was critiquing the state-sponsored teaching, instruction of philosophy in Germany and in the 19th century. And of course, the way we teach philosophy today is quite open-ended. I have a lot of freedom as an instructor to teach philosophy as I would like, including doing the thing that Nietzsche says has never been done, which is asking students to try to live it, which is what I did in this intensive summer course that I just wrapped up teaching. It speaks to me on a more personal level because I feel the force of Nietzsche's critique, because I do think looking back that my teaching really was a kind of battle of words against words rather than an attempt to put the theories I was teaching into practice. And what changed that for me was COVID and the pandemic. Because I've been teaching ancient Greek and Roman ethical theory for many years. And it occurred to me when the shutdown began and we all kind of retreated into isolation that I had been teaching this whole time philosophical theories that were highly applicable to our current situation and really to any situation. And I realized that I kind of had an opportunity in the privileged position that I'm in to be able to teach philosophy to try doing the thing that Nietzsche at least is implicitly suggesting we should be doing, which is to put the theories into practice.
Well, your course is called Philosophy as a Way of Life. And when you think about it, you could theoretically go to any number of philosophers or philosophical traditions down the ages for tips on how to live well. But you've gone to the ancients, which is where so many people go in search of philosophy as a way of life. Why do you think we keep returning to the ancient Greeks and Romans?
I think it's because what we find in ancient Greek and Roman philosophy is hundreds of years of reflection on a question that is all central to our lives in one way or another, which is, how do I live a good life? It's a question that you don't have to be a professional philosopher to ask yourself. In some way or other, I think everybody asks themselves that at some point or other in their lives. And we have in the Greek and Roman ethical tradition a significant body of work that is a sustained examination of exactly that question from different points of view and offering different answers. So I think we keep going back to it because I think it's unique among periods in the history of philosophy, at least in the Western tradition, of this kind of singular focus on the question of how to live a good human life. And of course, that's something that we all want to do and the ancients thought we all want to do.
Jessica, you came to this course as a philosophical novice. I'm really interested in what made you interested in signing up.
I actually, in 2019, I was getting interested in philosophy just because I had a period I'd gone through where I was just totally nihilistic, I guess, and I was looking for kind of meaning to life and, you know, purpose. And I feel like a lot of uni students go through that, just wondering, what am I doing with my life and my degree, and am I in the right major and whatnot? So I stumbled upon Stoicism on YouTube, and I found somebody who had done a TED Talk. He was a successful CEO giving a TED Talk presentation and telling about how he had started off as a university student who was happy-go-lucky on the outside, very extroverted. And, you know, in the span of 2 weeks, he was sitting in the back of his van planning to commit suicide. And he just was miserable and he couldn't pin down why. And luckily, though, he found stoicism and he claimed it turned his life around and, you know, gave examples of that. And I was like, yeah, I'm sold. I'll try and look into it a little bit more. And I searched up on our UNSW handbook if we had any philosophy classes I could take over this summer. And sure enough, we did. So I signed right on up.
And we're going to talk about happiness. To what extent was this part of a search for happiness for you? Were you unhappy? Were you consciously thinking, I need to get happier?
Well, actually, yeah. I guess because the quality of my life has kind of been up and down, I guess, like everybody else's throughout COVID. I mean, I'm definitely luckier than some, but we've all experienced some hardships through this time. So being able to find a course that would teach you different methods of living a good life, I thought would be beneficial to sign up for. So yeah, it did motivate me a little bit to sign up for the class.
Well, in a lot of Hellenistic philosophy, and particularly in Aristotelian ethics, we come across this word eudaimonia, which is often translated as happiness. Aristotle calls it the ultimate goal of all human action. But happiness is such a tricky thing to get a fix on. You know, everybody wants to be happy, but very few of us are sure how to be happy or even what happiness is. David, is there something in the concept, this concept of eudaimonia, that helps to pin it down?
Sure. I'd be glad to say a little bit about that. If you don't mind, David, do you mind if I just go back very quickly to your first question, though?
Sure.
Because there's just an additional thought that I think is worth articulating, and it's back to the quote from Nietzsche, which is that one of the things I think the quotation is helpful in bringing out is a question about the value of philosophy, which of course has become an important and kind of controversial question for us in Australia, given the government's recent changes to university funding schemes and so on. And what I find helpful in the quote from Nietzsche is that it points to the idea that it's common to defend the value of philosophy, and I think this is absolutely correct, to point out that actually different sectors value people with philosophy degrees and other humanities degrees and so on, that it actually is useful for getting a good job and so on. But I think what the quote brings out for me is the idea that actually what we should also be pointing out is that philosophy is a crucial preparation for the career that we're all going to have, which is the career of being human in the world. And that's something that I think is worth emphasizing and that we shouldn't lose sight of. And I think returning to the Greek and Roman ethical tradition is a way of kind of reclaiming that way in which philosophy can be valuable for our lives. And it's very intimately connected to this question of how the Greeks conceived and the Romans conceived of eudaimonia. That's the Greek term that's commonly translated happiness. Happiness, I think we tend to associate with a certain kind of feeling. Whereas eudaimonia, although it's often translated happiness, is probably better translated by a word such as flourishing. So it's not how you feel about your life. If you're living a eudaimon life, that has nothing really to do with how you feel about your life. It's about how your life is actually going. It's about the fact that you are flourishing in your life, that you are achieving distinctively human forms of excellence. And that's a kind of objective fact about you that is not connected with your own feelings about it. It has to do with the kinds of activities that you engage in, the state that your character is in, and so on.
It's closely connected to virtue as well, isn't it? And this is central to classical Greek and Roman philosophy. And Socrates, Aristotle, the Stoics, they're all very big on virtue. But again, this is a term that has a wide range of connotations in modern usage. What does virtue mean when we encounter it in classical ethics?
Yeah, so the Greek word, it's maybe useful to say a little bit about the Greek term that we translate as virtue. It's arete. Another translation that's probably more accurate is excellence. And the reason I say it's more accurate is that the Greek term arete applies considerably more widely than the concept of virtue for us. So, for example, you can speak of the arete of a horse or of a dog or even of a body part, the arete of an eye or the hand. You can also speak about the arete of inanimate objects, a knife or a car, something like that. And so in some ways, excellence gets closer to the Greek concept of arete. And there's a kind of common understanding in the period about what this thing, virtue or excellence, is. And that has to do with another key concept. Here the Greek word is ergon, which means something like your job or your work or your function is often how it's translated. And the basic idea is that the arete, the virtue of a thing, is its ability to do its work well. And it's a common thought among Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics that each kind of thing has its own special work to do. So humans, just in virtue of being humans, we have our own special work to do. And to have human virtue is to have the ability to do our work well. What those schools also agree on is that central to our human work is reason or our rationality. But that's the basic idea. To think about virtue in this period is to think about what is the specific job of the thing we're thinking about, and is it doing its job well? And if it is, then it's in this condition they call arete.
Jessica, as we talk about this, I'm wondering how studying all this and doing this course changed or perhaps confirmed your perception or your experience of things like virtue and happiness or flourishing.
I'm a chronic nihilist, I like to call myself. I tend to fall into these traps of thinking like, oh man, what's the point? And I feel like that's generally an easy thought process to fall into. But just from the fact that Stoicism presents a value system where there's a role for you, there's a purpose for you, it counters that nihilism that I sometimes feel, and it puts purpose in your life. And I really did appreciate that coming into this course, that we had to reflect on who we really are and what our role is in our circles. And I think finding that purpose can really change your mind on not necessarily virtue and what it is to be a good person. I feel like there's a definition of goodness that we all kind of carry. And maybe that's me agreeing with Stoicism and the virtue of Stoicism, but I definitely think that the purpose that is defined in Stoic roles has changed how I go about life. You know, if you're a sister, which I am, or you're a daughter, then you have a role as a daughter and a sister, and you're guided by virtue and rational thought, and that will make you the best version of being a sister you can be and the best version of being a daughter you can be. And I think there's some value in that, having that role there to live up to, even if it's the smallest thing. Because I think a lot of us, you know, kids my age, a lot of my friends, we have big ambitions for our life. And I think we keep getting met by this nihilistic train wreck of thought because we hold ourselves to these expectations too highly, and we're not very thankful for what we do have around us and, you know, the small things that life is made up of. And I think this class teaching us these Stoic principles has made us reflect on, you know, what really is my role among the people who I am closest to, and what is my role as a human being even, and how do I function? I think one of our days during Stoic Week, we had a passage from Marcus Aurelius that we had to reflect on during the day that was talking about the nature of a human. And he's just questioning, what is the nature of being a human being, and what's the nature of myself, and what is rational for me to do? And we had to go about the day thinking in small ways like that. What is it most rational for me to do right here, right now, in this moment? And I thought that was really cool.
This is RN. You're listening to The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge. And this week we're talking about the enduring popularity and contemporary relevance of ancient Greek and Roman philosophy. My guests are David Bronstein, a lecturer in philosophy at the University of New South Wales, who ran a summer course in January on philosophy as a way of life. And I'm also talking with Jessica Putnam, who's one of the students who took the course. David, part of the course involved living according to the principles of Stoic philosophy for a week. Now, Stoic philosophy has had a huge surge in popularity over the past few years, and this activity of living like a Stoic for a week is something that a lot of people like to do. What's involved, or at least what did your course require over the 7 days?
What I did was I divided the week in, so 7 days and 7 themes or activities. The first 2 days were living according to nature was Monday, and Tuesday was cultivating indifference. And that is one entry point into Stoic ethics. The 2 days were basically having to do with the fundamental Stoic principle that virtue is the only good. Really only one good thing, and that's being virtuous. There's only one bad thing as a consequence of that, which is being vicious, and everything else is merely indifferent. Now, the first day we spent really living, trying to live with this thought that virtue is the only good, and trying to live virtuously in the way the Stoics recommended, which is to live according to nature, is one of their slogans. And what that really amounts to, and this is what Jessica was talking about, was living according to reason. And the idea here was to think about our social roles and to think about some of the actions appropriate to those roles. And then also just to think about this again, what Jessica was talking about, just the role of being a human. The Stoics think of that itself as a role, which is to be rational. The second day, cultivating indifference, had to do with our attitude to the things that are neither good nor bad, that is neither virtuous nor vicious. And that involved giving something up significant from our lives. So something like your phone or social media or coffee or skipping a meal, something like that. I'll say a little bit now about the middle section of the week. So this was 3 days on the Stoic concept of fate, very difficult idea in Stoicism, the idea that everything is determined, everything is fated. So we spent some time thinking about the idea of accepting our fate. And we also spent time thinking about the difference between what is out of our control and what is within our control. And the crucial idea here for the Stoics is the only thing truly within my control are my choices, my decisions, my intentions, my mind, really. And they conceive of the human mind, especially, and this is clearest in the Roman Stoic Epictetus, they conceive of the human mind in particular in terms of the power of choice. And they think of choice, and this is some technical terminology I can explain a little bit, in terms of whether we or not we assent to our impressions. And so we spent some time thinking about that, about what's in our control, what's not in our control, and thinking about our own choices and decisions, opinions, and so on as the only things that we can really have full control over. The last 2 days we spent on some related Stoic themes. So the first was expanding our circle of affinity. And here we tried to put into practice the Stoic idea that we should really view everybody, and they literally mean everybody, every human being, as a co-equal citizen of the cosmopolis, of the universal city, and to try to think of strangers as literally family members. So kind of expanding our circle of affection and connection. And then the last day we spent somewhat grimly, but I think also somewhat hopefully and optimistically contemplating our own deaths, living in consciousness of death. The Roman Stoic Seneca has very powerful letters on this, extolling us to use our time wisely. So we each made a time use chart of our day, tracking our day's activities into certain categories and thinking about how we use our time.
Jessica, how did you go with it? And in particular, how far out of your comfort zone did it take you? Did you find any of it particularly difficult or challenging?
Well, yeah, I definitely found some things challenging to do. I know the one day where we had to give up something that was kind of a comfort to us and not assent to any impressions that it was bad that we had to go without it, that day was definitely difficult. I gave up my headphones, and I usually walk around the city with those because city noise, the traffic and everything, it can be quite loud, quite overwhelming. So I find it more comfortable to go around with those in just to drown some of that out. So some of it was difficult. The whole assenting to impressions and emotions, you know, our judgment of whether the impression you have is good or bad, that sort of fighting yourself every time that something comes up, an impression comes up, For example, it was actually funny, during Stoic Week, my sister and I went to a cafe after we had just gone and bought some new books from Dimmix, and she ended up spilling her coffee all over my book. But it was Stoic Week, so I was practicing not assenting to impressions. And my immediate impression that first came to me was, oh, this is bad. Like, my new book ruined. Oh, no. What do I do? How can a person have so little dexterity that they spill their coffee all over the table? And, you know, and I wanted to get angry, but then, you know, it was Stoic Week. So I gave pause to the moment and I thought to myself, no, it's not right for me to get angry, because this is nothing to get angry over. It's just spilt milk. It's spilt coffee. And I should calm down, maybe make a joke about it and, you know, move on with my day. It's not harmed me in any sort of way. So as the week went on, those types of activities, just thinking in that way of not assenting to impressions, became actually a useful tool to just give yourself time to actually think about what you're going to do next, instead of just act on the initial thought or emotion that you've been presented to by the world. And I think that's really helpful for people to learn, is to just give it a couple seconds, breathe and think, and don't immediately accept everything that is given to you.
What about this question of choice? I mean, David was talking a minute ago about making certain choices, choosing to respond in certain ways. And we know that Zeno, the founder of the Stoic school of philosophy, he compared fate and the human condition to a dog tied behind a cart. And he described this as, you know, wherever the cart goes, the dog has to go as well. And this is the dog exercising autonomy in conjunction with necessity, which is a weird kind of paradox. But I wonder what you make of that, and what you make of your own free will, your own choices. I mean, do they still feel like choices? Do you feel that you have the same sort of free will and autonomy and moral responsibility that you did a month ago?
Yeah, definitely, actually. I've always kind of liked the idea of free will. I enjoyed the idea of free will. So being faced with this dog tied to the cart analogy kind of rubbed me the wrong way at first, because I didn't want to be a dog tied to a cart and have to just follow, you know, wherever fate leads me. I really don't like that idea that our choices are firings of neurons in our brain and we don't have any say, actually, we just think we do. I don't like that at all. But I do think the way that the Stoics phrased it, having autonomy in conjunction with necessity. So no matter what, that cart is going to go in any direction it chooses, any way the driver chooses for it to go. But you have choices as you're tied to the rope. You can move around, right? So if another cart crosses your path and decides to sideswipe you, you can learn how to jump over it or move around left or right. And you can either walk the pace of the cart, or you can, you know, sit on your butt and be dragged. It doesn't matter. But I like to think of free will in that way, that you still have choices, but your future is unknown. So you don't know where you're going to end up. Fate decides that for you. But you definitely are in charge of your mind.
I just want to finish by bringing up the element of fatalism in Stoicism, and that resignation to live in the world as it is, rather than get all bent out of shape trying to fashion the world into the way that you think it should be. And Jean-Paul Sartre famously thought that Stoicism was designed to keep master and slave in their respective positions. And I want to ask you, is there something in Stoicism that stops it from being a recipe for political quietism, political inactivity, and just sort of and accepting things that we shouldn't? Because it brings up this point of, you know, what's the point of political action or struggling against injustice?
Yes. So I see the force of Sartre's critique. I definitely think there's something to this. So we don't have any Stoic texts, for example, arguing against the institution of slavery. I think, though, that it is a misinterpretation of Stoicism to say that it leads to political quietism. So I think here are some notable features that I think are relevant to this quietism objection. So one is that the Stoics themselves were very well aware of this argument. So Cicero reports what was called the lazy argument against the Stoic conception of fate, which is basically, why would I do anything if everything is fated, right? So if I'm sick, well, I'm fated to get better or I'm fated to stay sick. So why bother in calling a doctor? It's out of my hands. And the Stoic response is that, no, that's the wrong way to think about it. If you're fated to get better, you're fated to get better along with being fated to call the doctor. So actually, our own agency is important. We are participants in our fated events and actions. Of course, our own participation is fated, but it's still there. We are still participants. Another notable feature of Stoicism is that they were very politically active. Unlike the Epicureans, who sort of deliberately retreated from political life, the Stoics never advocated doing that. In fact, they advocated for participating in civic life and political life. And of course, the best example of that is Marcus Aurelius, who is the Roman emperor and a Stoic philosopher himself. So there's no inconsistency between being a Stoic and being politically active. Is there an inconsistency between being a Stoic and agitating for political change? For example, are advocating against the institution of slavery? I think that there is, because of the Stoic idea that part of our human nature, part of our work as humans is to be social animals, that we are born to live together. And the Stoic idea of seeing each and every person as a co-equal citizen in the cosmopolis, in the universal city, as an equal rational agent with an equal inner dignity. And I think that if we took those ideas seriously and followed through on their consequences, I think it would be quite clear what sorts of political actions would be appropriate. And I think we'd be highly motivated to, for example, argue against the institution of slavery or other forms of oppression. Where I think the Stoics will then come in, though, is to say that we need to remember the difference between what is up to us and what is not up to us, what we can control and what we cannot control. And what we can control, they think, fully control, are only our intentions. And that's what we really need to pay attention to, is the intentions behind our actions. Whether they come to fruition or not is not something that is up to us. That depends on the world, which we don't control. I don't think that should lead us to fatalism or quietism. And among the Stoics themselves, it didn't, because of all this evidence of how politically active they were. But it does provide a kind of maybe check on our expectations that we should try to change the world, try to promote the common good and the inner dignity of all equal citizens of the cosmopolis. But we shouldn't expect that our actions will turn out as we hope them to, or at least we shouldn't count on it.
David Bronstein, lecturer in philosophy at the University of New South Wales, and you also heard Jessica Putnam, who's a philosophy student at UNSW. More info available on the website, where you can also access our back catalogue of past programs, or you can find us via the ABC Listen app. This has been The Philosopher's Zone. I'm David Rutledge. You'll find me on Twitter at David P. Zone. Thanks for your company, and I hope you can join me again next week. Bye for now.